No, that isn't fair, Socrates. Neither you nor we would say it was.
Then we must look at the question your argument and Theodorus's raises in another way, it seems.
Yes, quite another way.
Let's look at it this way then. Is knowledge the same thing as perception, or different? That's really what our whole discussion has been aiming at, and that's why we stirred up all these strange questions. Isn't that so?
Absolutely.
Well then, shall we agree that whatever we perceive by seeing or hearing, we also know at that same moment? Take the case of foreigners whose language we don't yet understand. Shall we say we don't hear them when they speak, or that we both hear and understand what they say? And again, people who don't know how to read, looking at written letters, shall we say they don't see them, or that they know them since they see them?
We'll say we know just this much of them, Socrates, the very thing we see and hear, the shape and color of the letters we both see and know, and the pitch, high or low, of the sounds we both hear and recognize. But what the grammar teachers and interpreters teach about them, that we neither perceive by seeing or hearing, nor do we know.
Excellent Theaetetus, and it wouldn't be worth arguing with you about that so that you can keep growing. But look at this other point coming up and see how we're going to fend it off.
What point is that?
This one. If someone asked, is it possible for a person who has come to know something and still retains and preserves the memory of that very thing, not to know, at the moment he remembers it, that very thing he remembers? I'm being long-winded, it seems, but I just want to ask whether someone who has learned something and remembers it can fail to know it.
How could that be, Socrates? That would be monstrous.
Am I talking nonsense, then? Consider, don't you say that seeing is perceiving, and that sight is a kind of perception?
I do.
Then hasn't the man who saw something come to know that thing he saw, by the argument we just made?
Yes.
And what about memory? You do mean something by it.
Yes.
Memory of nothing, or of something?
Of something, surely.
Of things he learned and perceived, things of that sort.
Of course.
So whatever someone saw, he sometimes remembers it later.
He remembers it.
Even with his eyes shut, or does shutting his eyes make him forget it?
That would be absurd to say, Socrates.
And yet we must say it, if we're going to save our earlier position, otherwise it's gone.
I suspect as much myself, by Zeus, though I can't quite grasp it fully. Tell me how.
Like this. The man who sees, we say, has come to know the thing he sees, since sight and perception and knowledge have been agreed to be the same.
Quite so.
But the man who saw and came to know the thing he saw, if he shuts his eyes, remembers it but no longer sees it. Right.
Yes.
But does not see means does not know, if indeed sees means knows.
True.
So it follows that a man who has come to know something and still remembers it, does not know it since he doesn't see it. And we said that would be monstrous if it happened.
That's very true.
So something impossible turns out to follow, it seems, if one says that knowledge and perception are the same thing.
It looks that way.
Then each of them must be called something different.
I'm afraid so.
Then what in the world could knowledge be? It seems we must say it all over again from the beginning. And yet, Theaetetus, what are we even about to do?
About what?
It strikes me that we're behaving like some worthless rooster, crowing in triumph, and leaping away from the argument before we've actually won.
How do you mean?
We seem to be acting like professional debaters, securing agreement on the use of words, being satisfied to have gotten the better of the argument by some trick like that. And though we claim not to be contestants but philosophers, we don't notice that we're doing exactly what those clever men do.
I still don't understand what you mean.
Well, let me try to explain what I have in mind. We asked whether someone who has learned something and remembers it can fail to know it, and by showing that a man who saw something and then shut his eyes remembers it while not seeing it, we prove that he doesn't know it, even while he remembers it, which is impossible. And so the Protagorean myth is destroyed, and along with it your idea too, that knowledge and perception are the same thing.
So it seems.
And yet, my friend, I don't think it would have gone this way if the father of the other myth were still alive. He would have put up quite a defense. As it is, we're trampling on it now that it's an orphan. Not even the guardians Protagoras left behind are willing to come to its aid, and Theodorus here is one of them. So it looks like we'll have to defend it ourselves, for justice's sake.
It isn't really my job. Socrates, Callias, son of Hipponicus, is more the guardian of his ideas. We turned rather quickly from bare arguments toward geometry. Still, I'll be grateful to you if you defend him.
Well said, Theodorus. Consider, then, what my defense amounts to. One might agree to things even stranger than what we said before, if one doesn't pay close attention to the words, which is what we're mostly in the habit of doing, affirming, and denying. Shall I explain it to you, or to Theaetetus?
To both of us together, but let the younger one answer. He'll be less embarrassed if he trips up.
Well, here's the most formidable question of all, and it runs something like this. Is it possible for the same person, knowing something, not to know that very thing he knows?
Well, Theaetetus, what shall we answer?
It's impossible, I should think.
Not if you're going to maintain that seeing is knowing. What will you do with an inescapable question, caught, as the saying goes, down a well, when a bold questioner covers one of your eyes with his hand and asks whether you see his cloak with the covered eye?
I'll say no, not with that one, but with the other, yes.
So you both see, and don't see the same thing at once?
In a manner of speaking, yes.
That's not what I'm asking or claiming, he'll say. I only asked whether the thing you know you also don't know. But as it stands, you're shown to see a thing you don't see. And you've already agreed that seeing is knowing and not seeing is not knowing. So work out for yourself what follows from that.
Well, I work out that the consequence is the opposite of what I assumed.
And perhaps, my astonishing friend, you'd have run into even more trouble like that if someone had gone on to ask you whether it's possible to know something both sharply and dimly, to know it from close up but not from far away, to know the same thing both intensely and faintly, and a thousand other such things. The kind of ambush a mercenary skirmisher lying in wait with words would spring on you, once you'd set down knowledge and perception as the same. Hurling in hearing and smelling and perceptions of that sort, refuting you relentlessly and never letting up, until, marveling at his much-vaunted cleverness, you found yourself entangled in his snares, and once he had you in his grip and bound fast, he could then ransom you for whatever price the two of you agreed on. So you might ask, what argument will Protagoras offer in his own defense? Shall we try to state it ourselves?
By all means.
All the points we've just been making in his defense, I think he'll charge straight at us, full of contempt, and say, so this is the celebrated Socrates, when a little child was asked whether the same person could remember and not know the same thing at the same time, he got frightened, and because he couldn't see ahead, he said no, and made a laughingstock of me in the argument. But the truth, Socrates, you laziest of men, is this. When you examine one of my positions by questioning, if the person questioned answers as I would have answered and stumbles, then I am refuted. But if he answers differently, then the one questioned is refuted, not I. For instance, do you really think anyone will grant you that a memory present in someone of what he once experienced is the same kind of experience as the one he had while actually experiencing it, now that he's no longer experiencing it? Far from it. Or again, will he hesitate to admit that it's possible for the same person to know and not know the same thing? Or if he's afraid of that, will he ever grant that a person who has changed is the same as he was before he changed? Or rather, that he is even a single person and not many, indeed infinitely many, once change keeps occurring? If we really must be on our guard against catching each other out over mere words. "No, my good man," he'll say, "come at what I actually mean more nobly if you can, and refute this, that private perceptions do not arise for each of us, or that, granting they are private, what appears would be no more true for the one it appears to, or, if we must speak of being, would be so for whomever it appears to. As for talking about pigs and baboons, not only are you yourself behaving like a pig, you're persuading your listeners to treat my writings that way too, and that's not well done. For I maintain that the truth is as I've written it. Each of us is the measure of what is and what is not, yet one person differs enormously from another in just this respect, that different things are and appear to one than to another. And I am far from denying that there is such a thing as wisdom or a wise man. Rather, I call wise precisely the man who, for any of us to whom bad things appear and are, can by a change make good things appear and be instead. Don't chase after my words, though understand more clearly still what I mean in this way. Recall what was said before. To the sick man, what he eats appears and is bitter, while to the healthy man it is and appears the opposite. Well, we shouldn't try to make either of them wiser than the other. That isn't even possible. And we shouldn't say that the sick man is ignorant for judging as he does, while the healthy man is wise for judging differently. What's needed is a change from the one condition to the other, since the second state is better. And it's the same in education. One has to move from a worse condition to a better one. Only the doctor produces the change with drugs, while the sophist does it with words. It isn't that anyone ever takes a person who judges falsely and later makes him judge truly. That's not possible, since one cannot judge things that are not, nor anything other than what one is actually experiencing, and what one experiences is always true. Rather, I think, when someone is in a bad state of soul and judges things akin to that condition, a good state makes him judge other things of the same kind, things which some people, out of inexperience, call true appearances, while I call the one set better than the other, but not one bit truer. And as for the wise, my dear Socrates, I'm nowhere near calling them frogs. With respect to bodies, I call them doctors. With respect to plants, farmers. For I say that these people too, instead of the bad sensations plants have when something in them is weak, instill good and healthy and true sensations in them. And likewise the wise and good public speakers make what is beneficial seem just to their cities instead of what is harmful. For whatever seems just and fine to a given city is just and fine for that city as long as it holds that belief. But the wise man makes what is beneficial seem and be in place of what was harmful for them in each such case. On the same reasoning, the sophist too, who can educate his students in this way, is wise and worth a great deal of money to those he has educated. And so it is true both that some people are wiser than others and that no one judges falsely, and you, whether you like it or not, must put up with being a measure. For this is exactly how the argument holds together. Now if you can dispute this from the beginning, dispute it, set out a counter-argument. Or if you'd rather proceed by questioning, do that instead. There's no need to avoid it either. In fact, a person of sense should pursue it above everything. Only do this. Don't be unjust in your questioning. It would be quite absurd for someone who claims to care about virtue to do nothing, but act unjustly in arguments. And one acts unjustly in this business whenever one doesn't keep contests and conversations separate, treating them as one and the same, playing and tripping people up as much as one can in the one, but in genuine conversation being serious and correcting one's partner, pointing out to him only those errors into which he has been led by himself or by earlier discussions. If you do this, the people who spend time with you will blame themselves for their own confusion and perplexity, not you, and they'll pursue you and love you, while hating and fleeing from themselves, toward philosophy, so that they may become different people and be rid of who they were before. But if you do the opposite, as most people do, the opposite will happen to you, and you'll turn those who spend time with you against philosophy itself once they're older. So if you're persuaded by me, as was said before, you'll approach the question calmly, without hostility or combativeness, but with real goodwill, and consider what we actually mean when we say all things are in motion, and that whatever seems so to each person and city is so for that person or city. And from there you'll examine whether knowledge and perception are the same thing or different, rather than the way you were doing it just now, arguing from the ordinary usage of words and names, which most people drag about however it happens to suit them, and thereby create all sorts of puzzles for each other. This much, Theodorus, I've contributed on behalf of your friend, to the best of my ability, a small offering from small resources. If he were still alive, he would have come to his own defense in far grander style.
You're joking, Socrates. You've defended the man quite vigorously.
Well said, my friend. And tell me, did you notice, when Protagoras was speaking just now and reproaching us for arguing against his position by playing on a child's fears and calling it a kind of cheap cleverness, while praising the solemnity of his measure of all things, did you notice that he was urging us to take his argument seriously?
Of course I noticed, Socrates.
Well then, do you tell us to obey him?
Absolutely.
Then you see that everyone here except you is a child. So if we're going to obey the man, you and I need to question and answer each other and take his argument seriously. So he can't complain that we examined his argument as if playing games with mere boys.
But surely Theaetetus could follow a closely reasoned argument better than many men with big beards.
Not better than you, though, Theodorus. So don't imagine that I have to defend your departed friend by every means, while you get no defense at all. Come now, my good man, follow along a little way, at least until we know whether it's really you who must be the measure where geometrical figures are concerned, or whether everyone is equally capable, like you, in astronomy and the other fields in which you're said to excel.
It isn't easy, Socrates, to sit beside you and refuse to give an account of oneself. I was talking nonsense a moment ago, saying you'd let me off without stripping down and wouldn't force me the way the Spartans do. You seem to me to lean more toward Sion. The Spartans tell a man either to leave or strip, but you seem to me to play the part of Antaeus, rather. You don't let a man who approaches you go until you forced him to strip and wrestle with you in argument.
You've compared my affliction very aptly, Theodorus, though I'm actually tougher than those two. Countless Heracleses and Theseuses, strong in argument, have already run into me and given me a fine thrashing, yet I don't give up one bit more for it. Such is the strange passion that has taken root in me for this kind of exercise. So don't you begrudge me either, rub up against me and do us both some good.
I won't argue any further, lead on wherever you like. In any case, whatever fate you spin for me in this business, I must endure being tested by it. Only I won't be able to offer myself to you beyond what you've already proposed.
Even this much will be enough. And please watch closely for this, that we don't somehow slip into a childish kind of argument without noticing, and someone reproach us for it again.
Well, I'll try, as far as I'm able.
Then let's take up again the same point we did before, and see whether we were right or wrong to be unhappy and find fault with the argument for making each person self-sufficient in wisdom. And Protagoras conceded to us that some people surpass others regarding better and worse, and that these are the ones who are wise. Isn't that so?
Yes.
Now if he himself were here to agree to it, rather than us conceding it on his behalf in his defense, there would be no need to take it up again and secure it. But as things stand, someone might well say we have no authority to make that concession on his behalf. So it's better to come to a clearer agreement about this very point ourselves, for it makes no small difference whether it is so or not.
True.
Then let's not get our agreement from other quarters, but from his own argument in the shortest way possible.
How?
Like this. He says that whatever seems so to each person is so for the one to whom it seems so.
Yes, that's what he says.
Well then, Protagoras, we too are speaking of the beliefs of a human being, or rather of all human beings, and we say there is no one who does not consider himself wiser than others in some respects, and others wiser than himself in other respects. And indeed in the greatest dangers, when men are hard-pressed in wars or illness or storms at sea, they treat the leaders in each situation as if they were gods, expecting them to be their saviors, differing from the rest in nothing but knowledge. And the whole human world is full of people seeking teachers and rulers, for themselves and for other creatures and for their various trades, and believing in turn that some are competent to teach and to rule, and others not. And in all this, what else can we say except that human beings themselves believe that wisdom and ignorance exist among them?
Nothing else.
And don't they consider wisdom to be true thinking, and ignorance false belief?
Of course.
Well then, Protagoras, what are we to do with the argument? Shall we say that human beings always judge truly, or sometimes truly and sometimes falsely? For from either answer it follows that they don't always judge truly, but judge both ways. Consider, Theodorus, whether any follower of Protagoras, or you yourself, would be willing to fight to maintain that no one considers anyone else ignorant or holds false beliefs.
That's hard to believe, Socrates.
And yet the argument that man is the measure of all things is driven to exactly this conclusion.
How so?
Whenever you form a judgment about something in your own mind and declare it to me as your belief, then, according to his argument, this is true for you. But is it not possible for the rest of us to become judges of your judgment? Or do we always judge that you believe truly? Or do countless people, every time, oppose you with contrary beliefs, thinking that you judge and believe falsely?
Yes, by Zeus. Socrates, countless indeed, as Homer says, are those who give me trouble from other people.
Well then, do you want us to say that you at that moment believe truly for yourself, but falsely for the countless others?
It seems that must follow from the argument.
And what about Protagoras himself? Isn't it necessary that, if neither he himself nor the majority of people believe that man is the measure, as indeed they don't, then this truth he wrote about would be true for no one at all. But if he himself believed it, while the majority don't share his opinion, then you realize that, first of all, to the extent that those who disagree outnumber those who agree, to that same extent it is more not the case than the case.
That must follow, if indeed it is to be, and not to be depending on each individual belief.
And next comes the cleverest point of all. He concedes, about his own opinion, that the opinion of those who hold the opposite view, the view that he is wrong, is true, since he admits that everyone believes what is the case.
Certainly.
Then wouldn't he be conceding that his own view is false, if he admits that the view of those who consider him wrong is true?
Necessarily.
But the others, for their part, don't concede that they themselves are wrong, do they?
No, they don't.
And he, in turn, admits that this belief, too, is true, on the basis of what he has written.
Apparently.
So it will be disputed by everyone, starting with Protagoras himself. Or rather, it will be conceded by him himself, whenever he grants that the person who says the opposite believes truly, at that point, Protagoras himself will be conceding that not even a dog, nor any random human being, is the measure of anything he hasn't learned. Isn't that so?
So it seems.
Then, since it is disputed by everyone, Protagoras's truth would be true for no one, not for anyone else, and not even for the man himself.
We're running my friend down rather severely, Socrates.
But look, my friend, it isn't even clear that we're running past what's right. It stands to reason that, being older, he's wiser than we are. And if he could suddenly pop up out of the ground right here up to the neck, he would very likely expose plenty of nonsense in me and, I'd guess, get agreement from you too, and then sink back down and go running off. But we, I think, have no choice but to make use of ourselves as we are, and to keep saying whatever seems true to us. And so now, too, shall we say that anyone at all would agree to this much, that one person can be wiser than another, and also more ignorant.
That's certainly how it seems to me.
And would the argument best hold its ground at the point where we sketched it out in Protagoras's defense, that most things are, for each person, just as they seem to him, hot, dry, sweet, and everything of that sort? But if it's ever going to be conceded that one person differs from another in anything, it would be willing to grant this concerning what is healthy and what causes disease, that not every little woman or child, or even an animal, is capable of curing itself by knowing what is healthy for it, but that here, if anywhere, one person differs from another.
That's how it seems to me, too.
And the same holds for matters of the city, the fine and the shameful, the just and the unjust, the pious and the impious. Whatever each city decides on and enacts as its own law, that is what's true for that city. And in these matters, no private person is any wiser than another, nor is one city wiser than another. But when it comes to laying down what's advantageous or not advantageous for itself, there, if anywhere, he'll agree that one adviser really does differ from another, and one city's judgment from another's, as measured against the truth. He wouldn't dare to claim that whatever a city enacts as advantageous, believing it so, is bound to turn out advantageous. But in the other matter I mentioned, the just and unjust, the pious and impious, they're willing to insist that none of these has any fixed nature of its own, that whatever a community collectively decides becomes true the moment it's decided, and stays true for just as long as the decision stands. Even those who don't go the whole way with Protagoras's doctrine end up handling wisdom something like this. But look, Theodorus, one argument keeps overtaking us, a bigger one springing from a smaller.
Well, we've got the leisure for it, haven't we, Socrates?
So it seems. And in fact, my good man, I've often noticed before, and I notice again now, how natural it is that people who have spent a long time in philosophy look ridiculous when they show up in a courtroom as speakers.
What do you mean by that?
Those who have been dragged through courtrooms and the like since they were young, compared with those raised in philosophy and that sort of pursuit, I'd guess the first are like household slaves next to free men.
How so?
In this way, the philosophers always have what you just called leisure, and they carry on their discussions at their ease in peace. Just as we ourselves are now taking up a third topic in place of the last one. And so it is with them too, if whatever comes along pleases them more than the subject in hand, as has happened to us. And it makes no difference to them whether they speak long or short, so long as they hit on what's really so. But the others are always talking against the clock. The water clock keeps pressing them on, and they aren't free to make their speeches about whatever they'd like. Their opponent stands over them under compulsion, with the sworn deposition being read out alongside, which they aren't allowed to stray from. Their speeches are always about a fellow slave, addressed to a master seated on the bench, holding some lawsuit in his hands. The contests are never for some abstract prize, but always for the man's own stake, and often life itself is on the line. All this makes them tense and sharp, skilled at flattering the master with words and courting him with deeds, but small in soul and crooked. Their growth, their straightness, their freedom, all this is stripped away by slavery from their youth, forcing them into crooked practices, throwing great dangers and fears onto souls still soft, burdens they can't bear along with justice and truth. So they turn at once to lying and to cheating one another in return, and get bent and twisted so many times over that they end up going from boys to men with nothing sound left in their minds, though they think themselves clever and wise. Well, that's the sort they are, Theodorus. Now do you want us to go through the men of our own chorus, or leave that be and turn back to the argument, so we don't overindulge, as we were just saying, in this freedom, and hopping from one topic to another?
No, not at all. Socrates, go through them. You put it very well just now, that we who dance in this sort of chorus aren't servants of our arguments, but our arguments are like servants to us, and each one waits around to be finished off whenever we see fit. There's no judge standing over us, and no audience either, ready to find fault and set the rules, the way there is for poets.
Let's talk then, it seems, since that's your pleasure, about the leaders among them. For what would anyone say about those who spend their time in philosophy only half-heartedly? These men, from their youth, don't even know the way to the marketplace, or where the courthouse is, or the council chamber, or any other public meeting place of the city. Laws and decrees, spoken or written, they neither see nor hear. The scrambling of political clubs after office, their meetings, dinners, and revels with flute girls, such things don't even occur to them in a dream. Whether someone in the city has turned out well or badly, or what trouble has come down to a man from his ancestors, on the father's side or the mother's, escapes him more thoroughly than, as they say, the pints of water in the sea. And he doesn't even know that he doesn't know all this. He doesn't hold back from it for the sake of reputation, but really and truly, it's only his body that lies and dwells in the city, while his mind, judging all these things petty and worthless, disdains them utterly and takes wing, as Pindar says, to survey the earth from below and its flat surface, to chart the stars above the heavens, and to search out the whole nature of everything that is in every direction, never lowering itself to anything close at hand.
What do you mean by that, Socrates?
The same sort of thing happened to Thales, Theodorus. He was studying the stars, looking upward, and fell into a well. And they say a clever and pretty Thracian servant girl made fun of him, saying he was so eager to know what was up in the sky that he couldn't see what was in front of him, right at his feet. The same joke fits everyone who spends his life in philosophy. Truly, such a man doesn't notice his neighbor next door, not just what he's doing, but hardly even whether he's a man or some other creature. What a human being is, though, and what it belongs to such a nature to do or undergo that's different from anything else, that he searches after and goes to great trouble to work out. You follow me, Theodorus, or not?
I do, and what you say is true.
So, my friend, when a man like this meets someone in private or in public, as I said at the start, if he's forced, in a courtroom or somewhere else, to talk about what's right at his feet and in front of his eyes, he gives the whole crowd something to laugh at, not just the Thracian girls, falling into wells and every kind of confusion out of sheer inexperience. His awkwardness is dreadful, and it makes him look like a fool. When it comes to insults, he has nothing of his own to throw at anyone, since he knows no evil of anyone, never having bothered to learn any. So, at a loss, he looks ridiculous. And when others sing their own praises and boast, his laughter is plainly not put on but genuine, and so he seems a simpleton. When he hears a tyrant or a king praised, he thinks he's hearing about one of the herdsmen, a swineherd, say, or a shepherd, or a cowherd, congratulated on how much he's managed to milk out of his flock. except he thinks such men have a harder and more treacherous animal to shepherd and milk, and that a man like that, penned in behind his walls up on some hill, is bound to grow just as coarse and uneducated as any herdsman, for want of leisure. And when he hears that someone owns 10,000 acres of land, or even more, and thinks that's an amazing amount to possess, it sounds to him like next to nothing, since he's used to taking in the whole earth at a glance. And when men chant their pedigrees, someone proud to point to 7 wealthy grandfathers, he thinks their praise is altogether dull-eyed and short-sighted, since through lack of education they can't keep the whole picture in view, or work out that everyone has had countless thousands of grandfathers and ancestors before him, among whom rich and poor, kings and slaves, barbarians and Greeks, have turned up again and again for anyone you like. When people pride themselves on a roll of 25 ancestors and trace their line back to Heracles, son of Amphitryon, he finds the pettiness of it absurd, that they don't stop to reckon that the 25th ancestor back from Amphitryon was whatever chance made him, and so was the 50th before that. He laughs at their inability to do the arithmetic and shake off the puffed-up folly of an unreflective mind. In all these situations, then, such a man is laughed at by the crowd, partly because he seems arrogant, partly because he's ignorant of, and at a loss over, what's right in front of him.
What you describe is exactly how it happens, Socrates.
But then, my friend, when he himself pulls someone up out of that world and gets him to leave behind questions like, "What wrong have I done you or you me?" and turn instead to examining justice and injustice in themselves, what each of them is, and how they differ from everything else and from each other, or to leave behind, is a king happy? Does he own piles of gold? And turn to examining kingship and human happiness and misery generally, what sort of things they are, and in what way it belongs to a person by nature to attain the one and escape the other, when it's time for that small, sharp, litigious mind to give an account of all this, then it's his turn to return the joke. Hung dizzy from the height, staring down bewildered from up there, unused to it, at a loss, stammering, he no longer gives the Thracian girls anything to laugh at, or any other uneducated person, since they don't even notice, but he gives it to everyone who's had the opposite upbringing from slaves. That Theodorus is the character of each, the one truly raised in freedom and leisure, the man you call a philosopher, who can't be blamed for seeming simple and useless when he's dropped into some menial task, not knowing how to pack up his own bedroll, say, or season a dish, or turn out flattering speeches. The other, who can handle all such tasks briskly and sharply, but doesn't know how to drape his cloak properly like a free man, or catch the true harmony of words to sing, as it should be sung, the truly happy life of gods and blessed men.
If you could persuade everyone of what you're saying, Socrates, just as you've persuaded me, there'd be more peace and less evil among mankind.
But evil can't be destroyed, Theodorus. There must always be something opposed to the good, nor can it have its seat among the gods. It must, of necessity, haunt mortal nature and this region here below. That's why we should try to escape from here to there as quickly as we can. And escape means becoming like God so far as that's possible, and becoming like God means becoming just and pious, with understanding. But it's not at all easy, my excellent friend, to convince people that the reason most men give for avoiding wickedness and pursuing virtue, that one should practice the one, and not the other for the sake of seeming good rather than bad, isn't the real reason. That, it seems to me, is just old wives' babble. Let's state the truth instead. God is in no way, in no respect, unjust, but as just as it's possible to be, and nothing is more like him than whichever of us becomes most just in turn. This is the true measure of a man's ability, and of his worthlessness and unmanliness. Knowing this is wisdom and true virtue, not knowing it is plain ignorance and vice. All the other so-called abilities and forms of cleverness, when found in political power, are vulgar, and in the arts, mechanical. So for the man who does wrong and speaks or acts impiously, by far the best course is not to grant that his wrongdoing makes him clever. Such men glory in the reproach, thinking it means people take them for something other than fools, mere dead weight on the earth, but as the sort of men a city needs to survive. We should tell them the truth instead, precisely because they don't think themselves such, they are all the more truly such, for they're ignorant of the penalty of injustice, which is the one thing it's least excusable to be ignorant of. It isn't what they imagine, beatings and executions, which sometimes fall even on those who have done no wrong, but a penalty impossible to escape.
What penalty do you mean?
Since there really are two patterns set up in the world, my friend, one divine and perfectly happy, the other godless and perfectly wretched, people don't see that this is so, and in their stupidity and utter thoughtlessness, they don't even notice that through their unjust actions, they're becoming like the one and unlike the other. And for this they pay a penalty. They go on living out the kind of life that resembles what they've become. If we tell them that unless they rid themselves of this cleverness of theirs, that place free of evils won't receive them even when they die, and that here on earth they'll go on forever having a life that matches the sort of person they are, bad people spending their time with other bad people. When they hear all this, being the clever, cunning men they are, they'll think it's just the ravings of fools.
Very much so, Socrates.
I know it, my friend, but there's one thing that happens to them. When it comes to a private conversation, when they have to give and take an account of the very things they condemn, and they're willing to hold out bravely for a good long while instead of running off like cowards, then, strange as it is, my good man, in the end, they're not satisfied with their own arguments about these very things, and that famous rhetoric of theirs somehow withers away, so that it seems no better than a child's babbling. Well, since this is really a digression from our subject, let's drop it. Otherwise, more and more will keep pouring in and burying our original argument, and let's go back to where we were before, if that's all right with you.
For my part, Socrates, I don't find such things unpleasant to hear. They're easier to follow for someone my age. Still, if you think we should, let's return to the argument.
Well then, we were somewhere around the point where we said that those who claim reality is in flux, and that whatever seems true to each person is true for that person, are willing to insist on this most strongly in other matters, and not least concerning what is just. That whatever a city establishes as its considered judgment is indeed just for that city, for as long as it remains established. But when it comes to what is good, no one is brave enough anymore to maintain, in the same way that whatever a city establishes as beneficial to itself, believing it to be so, is in fact beneficial for exactly as long as it's established as such, except perhaps someone quibbling over the mere name, which would really just be mockery of what we're discussing, wouldn't it?
Certainly.
Let's not have him quibble over the name, then. Let him look at the thing that's named.
Let's not, indeed.
Well, whatever name the city gives this thing, that's surely what it's aiming at when it makes law, and it establishes all its laws, so far as it can judge and manage, as the most beneficial to itself it can. Or is it looking toward something else when it legislates?
Not at all.
And does it always hit the mark, or does each city often miss badly?
I should think it misses too.
There's a further point that would make everyone agree with this even more readily if the question were asked about the whole class of things to which the beneficial belongs. That, I take it, has to do with future time as well. For whenever we legislate, we lay down our laws on the assumption that they'll be beneficial in time to come, and that's rightly called the future.
Certainly.
Come then, let's ask Protagoras, or anyone else who says the same things he does, this. Man is the measure of all things, you say, Protagoras, of white, heavy, light, and everything of that sort. For having the standard for judging them in himself, he thinks things are the way he experiences them, and so he believes them to be true for himself and real. Isn't that so?
It is.
Then does he also, we'll say, Protagoras, hold the standard within himself for things that are going to be, and does whatever he thinks will happen actually come about for the one who thought it? Take heat, for instance. When an ordinary person thinks he's coming down with a fever and that this heat is going to occur, while another person, a doctor, thinks the opposite, according to whose judgment should we say the future will turn out? Or according to both, so that for the doctor he'll turn out neither hot nor feverish, but for himself he'll be both.
That would be absurd.
No, I think when it comes to the sweetness or dryness a wine is going to have, it's the farmer's judgment that counts, not the lyre player's.
Of course.
Nor, again, would a trainer judge better than a musician about whether something is going to be in tune or out of tune, something that will later seem well-tuned to the trainer himself.
Not at all.
So, too, when a meal is being prepared, the judgment of someone who isn't a cook about the pleasure it's going to give is less authoritative than the cook's judgment when that person is going to be the one dining. As for what's already pleasant to someone or has already happened to be pleasant, let's not argue about that just yet. But as for what's going to seem pleasant and going to be pleasant to each person, is each person the best judge of that for himself? Or would you, Protagoras, judge in advance, better than any layman, what argument is going to persuade each of us in a courtroom?
Indeed, Socrates, that's exactly what he claimed to be better at than anyone, that above all.
Yes, by Zeus, my friend. Otherwise no one would have paid him large sums of money to talk with him, if he hadn't persuaded the people around him that when it comes to what's going to happen, and what's going to seem so, neither a prophet nor anyone else could judge better than the man himself.
Perfectly true.
And legislation, too, and the beneficial, concern the future. So wouldn't everyone agree that a city, in making its laws, is often bound to miss what's most beneficial?
Very much so.
Then we'll be speaking fairly to your teacher when we say that he's forced to admit that one man is wiser than another, and that such a man is the measure. While for me, who knows nothing, there's no necessity at all that I become the measure, as the argument on his behalf just now was forcing me to be, whether I wanted it or not.
That seems to me, Socrates, the point where the argument is most caught out, caught also in this. That it makes other people's opinions authoritative, and these opinions turned out to regard his own statements as not true at all.
In many other ways, too, Theodorus, a claim like this, that every opinion of everyone is true, could be caught out. But regarding each person's present experience, from which perceptions and the opinions that go with them arise, it's harder to convict these of being untrue. Perhaps I'm talking nonsense, though. Maybe they really are impregnable, and those who claim they're clear and count as knowledge may well be saying something true, and our friend Theaetetus here wasn't off the mark in identifying perception with knowledge. So we must come in closer, as the argument on Protagoras's behalf demands, and examine this reality in motion, tapping it to see whether it rings sound or cracked. There's been no small fight over it, and not a few fighters.
Far from small, in Ionia, in fact, it's spreading enormously. Heraclitus's followers champion this doctrine with great vigor.
All the more reason, my dear Theodorus, to examine it thoroughly, starting from the beginning, just as they themselves present it.
By all means. And indeed, Socrates, concerning these followers of Heraclitus, or, as you put it, of Homer and thinkers even older, the men themselves around Ephesus, who claim expertise in it, are no more possible to have a discussion with than madmen driven by a gadfly. They're literally swept along in accordance with their own writings, as for staying still on a point in an argument and calmly answering and asking in turn. There's less of that in them than nothing at all. Rather, the sheer absence of any stillness in these men goes beyond nothing. It's less than nothing. If you ask one of them something, he pulls out little riddling phrases from a quiver, as it were, and shoots them at you. And if you try to get an account of what he meant, you'll be struck by another one, freshly renamed. You'll never come to any conclusion with any of them, and they don't with each other either. They're very careful to let nothing stand firm, either in argument or in their own souls, believing. So it seems to me that stability itself is the enemy. They wage relentless war on it and drive it out from everywhere, as far as they're able.
Perhaps, Theodorus, you've seen the men in combat and haven't kept company with them at peace, for they're not your friends. But I imagine they explain these things to their students at leisure, whomever they want to make like themselves.
What students, my good man? None of these people becomes anyone else's student. They spring up on their own, wherever each happens to catch the inspiration, and each thinks the other knows nothing. So from them, as I was about to say, you never get an account, willing or not. We have to take the problem up ourselves and examine it as if it were a puzzle set before us.
And that's a fair point. Well, this puzzle we've inherited, haven't we gotten it in one form from the ancients, who concealed their meaning from the many under the veil of poetry, saying that the origin of everything else, ocean and Tethys, are flowing streams, and nothing stands still. And in another form from the more recent thinkers, who, being wiser, declare it openly, so that even the shoemakers among their audience can learn their wisdom by hearing it and stop foolishly believing that some things stand still while others move, and learning instead that everything moves, honor them for it. But I nearly forgot, Theodorus, that others in turn have declared the opposite of all this, such as unmoving is the name for the whole, and all the other things that Melesus and Parmenides maintain, in opposition to all these people, insisting that all things are one and it stands still in itself, having no room in which to move. What then, my friend, are we to do with all these people? For advancing little by little, we've found ourselves, without noticing, caught in the middle between both sides, and unless we somehow fight our way clear and escape, we'll pay the penalty, like those who play the line game in the wrestling schools, when they're grabbed by both sides and dragged in opposite directions. So it seems to me we should first examine the one group, the ones we set out after, those who say everything flows, and if they seem to be saying something sound, we'll pull ourselves over to their side, trying to escape the others. But if the partisans of the unmoving whole seem to speak more truly, we'll flee to them instead, away from those who set even the unmoving things in motion. And if both sides turn out to be saying nothing reasonable, we'll look ridiculous, thinking that we mere nobodies have something worth saying, while we've rejected men of great age and great wisdom. So consider, Theodorus, whether it's worth advancing into so great a danger.
It's quite unbearable, Socrates, not to examine what each of these two schools of men is saying.
Examine it we must, then, since you're so eager. It seems to me the starting point of the inquiry should be about motion, what exactly they mean when they say all things move. I mean something like this. Do they speak of it as a single kind, or, as it seems to me, as two? But don't let it seem so to me alone. Join in with me, so that whatever happens to us in the process, we experience it together. Tell me, do you call it motion when something changes place from one place to another, or also when it spins in the same place?
I do.
Let that, then, be one kind. But when a thing stays in the same place yet grows old, or becomes black from white, or hard from soft, or undergoes some other alteration, isn't that worth calling a different kind of motion?
It seems to me it must be, yes.
So I call these two kinds of motion, alteration and change of place.
Rightly said.
Having made this distinction, then, let's put the question to those who claim all things move and ask, do you say everything moves in both ways, both changing place and altering, or does part of it move in both ways and part in only one?
Well, by Zeus, I can't say, but I think they'd say both ways.
Because otherwise, my friend, things will appear to them both moving and standing still, and it will be no more correct to say that all things move than to say they stand still.
Very true.
So since these things must move, and not moving belongs to none of them, everything is always moving in every kind of motion.
It must be so.
Now look at this point with me. When we spoke of the coming to be of heat, or whiteness, or anything else, didn't we say something like this, that each of these travels, together with perception, in between the agent and the patient, and the patient becomes something that has the capacity to perceive, but is not yet a perception, while the agent becomes something of a certain quality, but is not yet a quality itself? Perhaps quality sounds like a strange word all at once, and you don't follow it stated in one lump, so let me put it piece by piece. The agent is neither heat nor whiteness, but it becomes hot or white, and so on with the rest. You'll remember from before that we said nothing is one thing by itself, not even the agent or the patient, but out of the two of them coming together with each other, perceptions and perceived things are born, the one becoming somehow qualified, the other becoming a perceiver.
I remember, of course.
Well then, let's leave the rest aside, whether they put it this way or that, and hold on to only the point for which we're saying this, and ask, are all things in motion and flux, as you people say? Isn't that so?
Yes.
And in both the kinds of motion, we distinguished moving in place and altering.
Of course, if it's really going to be complete motion.
Now if things merely moved in place without altering, we could say what sort of things these moving things are as they flow, or how else would we put it?
Just so.
But since not even this stays put, that the white thing flowing is white, but it changes, so that there is a flow of this very thing, whiteness, and a change into another color, so that it can never be caught staying put in that respect, can one ever call any color by name in a way that names it correctly?
How could one, Socrates, or name anything else of that sort, if it's always slipping away as one speaks, being in flux as it is?
And what shall we say about any perception whatsoever, seeing, say, or hearing? Does it ever stay put in the very act of seeing or hearing?
It shouldn't, at least, if everything is in motion.
Then we shouldn't call it seeing any more than not seeing, nor any other perception any more than not, given that everything, in every way, is in motion.
No, we shouldn't.
And yet perception is knowledge, as Theaetetus and I said.
That's what we said.
So when we were asked what knowledge is, we answered with something no more knowledge than not knowledge.
So it seems.
It would be a fine correction to our answer, after all our eagerness to prove that everything moves, just so that answer would turn out right. But instead, it seems, what's come to light is that, if everything moves, every answer on whatever subject one answers is equally correct. One can say it is so, and equally that it is not so, or, if you like, that it comes to be so, so as not to pin the movers down with our own words.
You're right.
Except Theodorus that I said so and not so. But one oughtn't even say so, for then it would no longer be moving this so, nor not so either, for that isn't motion. Rather, the people who hold this theory need to establish some other kind of language, since as things stand they have no words to fit their own position, unless perhaps not even so suits them best, said without limit.
That's certainly the dialect most natural to them.
Well then, Theodorus, we're rid of your friend, and we're still not conceding to him that every man is the measure of all things, unless he's a man of good sense. Nor will we concede that knowledge is perception, at least not by the method that has everything in motion, unless our friend Theaetetus has some other way of putting it.
Excellently said, Socrates. For once this business is settled, I too was supposed to be released from answering you, according to our agreement, once the argument about Protagoras reached its end.
Not before, Theodorus, you and Socrates have gone through those who claim, on the contrary, that the whole stands still, just as you proposed a moment ago.